Our collective nightmare, a nursing home on the outskirts of Philadelphia, lit itself on fire and then exploded on Tuesday. Two people are dead, one employee, one resident, and 20 were rushed to hospitals. One remains in critical condition. Everyone has been accounted for, which is the small mercy the officials were able to offer between the smoke and the paperwork. Authorities say a gas leak is the likely cause. The utility company on the scene reported crews smelled gas, shut off service, and then watched the building blow up while they were still there. Firefighters pulled people from windows, stairwells, and elevator shafts while the stench of gas hung in the air and walls threatened to fall. About 15 to 30 seconds after the first crews left, there was another blast. That was the part where the emergency plan looked like improvisation under a circus tent that had already caught fire. The National Transportation Safety Board is leading the investigation. They will not be able to properly inspect the gas service line until heavy machinery clears a safe path, which could take days. In the meantime, the company that might have been involved says it is not known if their equipment played a role. That sentence is the kind of sentence we keep repeating because it costs less than admitting blame. The building partially collapsed, the cafeteria dropped into the basement, and a utility area that may hold the answer is now under concrete and ash. First responders describe pulling people who couldn't walk or speak into the light. One police officer threw two people over his shoulders and ran. Neighbors filmed from yards as if watching a municipal horror movie, then ran to help. Heroism happened. It always does in the cracks where policy fails. This nursing home changed ownership early in December. Inspectors visited on December 10th and a plan to upgrade standards was drawn up. The facility had been cited in October for failing to maintain portable fire extinguishers on one floor, for blocked stairway access, and for missing smoke barrier partitions. Medicare gives it a much below average rating. No one likes to say the words that make the whole setup obvious. A vulnerable building, vulnerable people, and a system that treats safety like an optional add-on. Officials promise an investigation, and the company promises to continue work. The state promises it takes complaints seriously but cannot comment on whether there will be a survey. The NTSB will document and examine and write a report that will sit in a folder and in a website archive. New ownership says they will fix prior issues and continue work. That is the exact choreography of how responsibility usually performs itself after a catastrophe. We will learn some facts in time. We will learn even more about inspections, citations, and what was or wasn't fixed. We will watch videos of smoke and neighbors who thought an airplane had fallen on their block. We will praise first responders rightly. We will sign condolence cards and repost official statements. And the business of aging, the thing that makes people disposable in the most ordinary way, will keep being bought and sold and patched with plans and promises until another building, another list of violations, another line in a report reminds us that promises were cheaper than prevention. The headline is simple. People who could not run were burned, carried, and saved by strangers while systems sputtered. The verdict is familiar. We are very good at making rules on paper and very bad at being prepared for greed, neglect, and the slow unraveling that follows. The rest will be left to investigators, lawyers, and the slow, polite machinery of excuses. The living will go to reunification centers. The dead will be counted and then become talking points for the next round of reforms that will arrive just in time to be renamed.
I spent 5 hours making chocolate acorns I found on Pinterest because the recipe promised 45 minutes and the photo promised internet validation. I bought lint, hunted down Nutter Butters, made an emergency grocery run at midnight, adjusted chocolate temps like I was diffusing a bomb, and ended up with parchment sheet abstract art that looked nothing like an acorn and everything like regret. At 1 a.m., staring at misshapen peanut butter blobs, I finally read the site more closely and found out my life had been curated by a ghost. Anna Kelly, pastry genius, nephew calls her Aunt Sarah, created in 2019, copyrighted 2025. The bite-sized Nutter Butters didn't fit the big ones. The photos had blueberries that looked like CGI craters. There were zero comments or reviews. My first world problem had a middleman, an AI. It turns out these aren't innocent mistakes. They're industrial trickery. Bots scrape real blogs, remix recipes, slap on glossy fake photos, register 100 domains, and make money every time you scroll. The math is brilliant. Spend minutes generating content, sell ad impressions, rinse, repeat. One real food blogger spends hours testing a recipe. A spam machine copies a dozen lines and earns the same ad dollars. It's like artisanal theft. Platforms say they're trying to help. Pinterest added an AI filter you can toggle like a privacy incense. It flags about half the fake pictures and leaves the rest to fester, which makes sense. When the metric is how long people keep scrolling, it's cheaper to let the internet offer you fake desserts than to actually fix the problem. Engagement greater than truth. New motto: if it scrolls, it monetizes. There's even a version of this in search results. AI overviews that mash up 10 real recipes into one Frankenstein checklist that will make you hungry and confused and possibly poison your dinner. The machines didn't learn to bake. They learned to write directions that look right and photos that look perfect enough to make you go to the grocery store at 11:30 p.m. So what's the comedic part? Only in a world where the worst thing that can happen is your party dessert isn't Instagrammable do we get personally betrayed by an algorithm. The machine stole my acorns, my lint, and 2 hours of my life, and all I got was a pile of chocolate blobs and the sudden urge to buy a cookbook from a real person with fingerprints on the pages. My takeaway: if a recipe promises 45 minutes, it's either lying, optimistic, or written by a bot that has never experienced an actual oven. And if Pinterest ever tries to sell you Aunt Sarah's secret, maybe just call your actual aunt.
The education department will start snipping chunks of paychecks in January, telling employers to withhold income from people whose federal student loans have gone unpaid for 270 days. Expect the first notices to land the week of January 7th, about 1,000 people, and then ramp up month to month until the program swallows whatever it can. This is not a glitch. Months after restarting collections, the administration is turning default into a revenue pipeline. Administrative wage garnishment and the resumed Treasury offset program together mean the federal government can reach beyond paychecks to tax refunds and even Social Security. If you liked the idea of retirement benefits being sacrosanct, you will not like the new definition of eligible income. The numbers are blunt. More than 5 million borrowers already in default. Nearly 4 million more delinquent. Millions of people could watch a slice of their paychecks vanish while bills for food, rent, and medicine keep arriving. Critics point out the obvious. This adds stress to people already squeezed by rising costs. But obvious rarely stops policy that's more punitive than practical. Meanwhile, Congress and the White House tighten the screws. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act capped graduate and parent borrowing, cut deferments, and narrowed repayment options. The SAVE plan was shelved, potentially kicking nearly 8 million borrowers into a hurried scramble for whatever limited relief remains. Defaulted borrowers can no longer pause payments, choose repayment plans, or easily dodge the collection machinery. Bankruptcy discharge is still a possibility, but only for the few who can navigate an arcane legal test. The story is simple and exhausting. Shrink the options, then punish the people left with them. Make loans harder to manage, then extract income and benefits when managing fails. It's efficiency dressed as policy, a tidy little machine that turns financial hardship into guaranteed federal revenue. Welcome to a system that solves public problems by privatizing pain.
This piece is based on a CNN article titled, "When Communities Are Grieving, He Comes Bearing a 10-Foot Cross." Here's his story. A man from Michigan builds a 10-foot cedar cross, puts wheels on it, and drives it to places that hurt. He sleeps in his truck, funds most of it himself, and says he feels a physical pull when a community needs him. He calls the cross a lamp and himself the lampstand. The cross is a spectacle, a sermon, a sight gag, and for some people, a comfort. There's something quietly hilarious and deeply human about the whole setup. We live in an era of instant information where grief and outrage travel faster than traffic. Yet when the rawness of loss arrives, whether from a shooting, a flood, or a fire, the response often includes rituals older than our social media feeds. Processions, candles, icons, monuments. Dan Beasley's cross is just one more. Ritual, but with a truck bed and a main-sized freight cost. Why do we attach meaning to objects? Because objects hold space. A cross on a street corner says, "Stop, look, breathe." It asks us to slow down long enough to admit that things are broken. It says simultaneously, there is more than this pain, and we don't have a better answer. Both statements can be true, and both are the kind of answers humans make when randomness hurts too much. There's irony in the way meaning migrates. Beasley started as skeptical, converted slowly, then watched a live stream of someone else carrying a cross, and felt called to copy that gesture across the country. The gesture spread like a meme, but with planks of cedar instead of pixels. The cross is portable religion, faith made hitchable. You can roll it into a vigil for school victims, to a memorial after an assassination attempt that injured others, or to a burned town. Each time it appears, people kneel, cry, pray, or photograph it for their feeds. The cross doesn't fix structures or policies. It doesn't unclench the economy or erase the randomness of tragedy. What it does is human-sized. It organizes attention and gives people permission to grieve together. There's also a performance problem. Beasley has questioning moments, wondering whether he's doing it for God or for the applause. That's the honest part. Humans are simultaneously noblest and tackiest, willing to act for others and secretly delighted when someone notices. Maybe the best gestures are the ones that admit that small hypocrisy and keep going anyway. So what do we learn if we're not ready to swear by cedar or wheels? We learn that we are meaning-making machines stuck on a spinning rock. We are allergic to randomness, so we build symbols, liturgies, and roadside attractions of consolation. We prefer a 10-foot cross rolling down the highway to the cosmic suggestion that nothing is looking out for us. And that preference, comforting, performative, a little absurd, is part of what keeps communities moving forward after something breaks. In the end, the cross is both literal and metaphoric. Heavy, awkward to load, and strangely effective. We carry each other with whatever we have. Planks, prayers, casserole dishes, policy debates, hashtags. None of it stops death or disaster, but it does one crucial thing. We stop being alone while we stare at the worst parts of being alive. That, absurdly, is often enough.
A $1.7 billion Powerball jackpot waits on Christmas Eve. An inflated promise of salvation packaged as seasonal spectacle. Monday's draw produced no jackpot winner. The numbers were 3, 18, 36, 41, 54, and red Powerball 7 with a power play of 2. 9 tickets match all 5 white balls for $1 million each, sold across Florida, Georgia, Illinois, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Wisconsin. A few people will sleep easier. The rest will keep buying hope by the dollar. This is the 47th drawing in a single jackpot run, a record the game boasts like a badge of honor. The prize is the fourth largest in Powerball history. The reigning champion remains the $2.04 billion anomaly of 2022. One of the only nights a jackpot has been claimed on Christmas Eve happened once, an odd footnote in a calendar of ritualized longing. The mathematics of it is obscene and neat. The odds of hitting the jackpot are 1 in 292.2 million. Smaller prizes exist, some as low as $4, a consolation buffet of coin flips to keep the machine humming. The drawings happen like clockwork, Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday at 10:59 p.m. Eastern Time, a metronome for consumer desperation. If someone wins on Wednesday, they'll be offered an annuity that pays out one immediate sum and 29 annual payments that swell by 5% each year, or a lump sum of about $781.3 million before taxes. The annuity is sold as stability. The lump sum as instant power. Both are tax-sliced, state-managed, and funneled into the same ecosystem that profits from the fantasy. 9 people found a $1 million consolation. No one found the whole thing. That gap is the entire point. The state-run lottery behaves like a charitable arm of capitalism, harvesting pennies from the many to erect a few private Shangri-Las. Buying a fake ticket is cast as civic participation. You spend money on branding, dreams, and the maintenance of inequality. These drawings are antiseptic theater. Numbers appear, a red ball spins, and millions consent to believe that an accident of chance will fix a lifetime of structural neglect. The spectacle accelerates during holidays, when loneliness and economic strain are easiest to monetize. The jackpot's calendar timing is not coincidence. It's a marketing cadence refined to extract maximum yearning. Fortunes won by rounding errors and tax tables obscure the more ordinary transfers. People trading labor for low wages, saving in jars instead of banks, and funneling spare change into a system that thrives on their hope. The game's largest payouts are headlines. The slow grind of extraction is the policy. The ritual of buying a chance to escape replaces any real conversation about redistribution, safety nets, or dignity. This is what prosperity looks like when reframed as a raffle. It's flashy, painless, and morally ambiguous by design. an entire apparatus that transforms pain into entertainment and then charges admission. The jackpot is not a solution. It's a symptom, a glittering lesion on a society that mistook desperation for opportunity.